Welcome, where business buying banter meets no BS reality. Get ready to dive into the world of buying and selling businesses without the fluff and fancy jargon. Whether you're a seasoned business buying pro or a curious aspiring entrepreneur, this is where the real talk happens. Because in business, there's no room for sugarcoating. Let's get down to the brass tacks.
Yeah, let's get down to the brass tacks, Richard.
Amen. I like it. You know, I was listening to the intro when they're talking about no sugarcoating. Well, that's certainly true from you and my perspective. But I started thinking about, my God, how many sellers sugarcoat, you know, their numbers, and which is a good introduction for what we're going to cover today.
That's right. And we're going to get right to the punch. Talking about seller ad backs, or SDE, we could call it as well. Would you say?
Yeah. And you know, the SDE, and one of the things that becomes very confusing for people that just getting into the market looking for buyers, it's called owner benefits. It's called ad backs. It's called seller's discretionary earnings. It's seller's adjusted cash flow. And in theory, it's all supposed to mean the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's incumbent upon the buyer to understand, okay, what's in that number? Like,
yeah,
you added this, plus this, and minus that. And then when it comes to the ad backs, being able to go through that, as we used to say, with a fine-tooth comb, which I don't say anymore because a fine-tooth comb won't do me much good.
Yeah. And I'd like to add that I think of sellers with all the years that I've been doing financing, they get skittish because they think when I do an SBA loan for a buyer, SBA is government, and if they tell me, the seller, you know, what they expensed in their tax returns, whether it be personal or they paid somebody in the family that's not working, and we'll get into that list, they're scared to tell me that, thinking, well, I'm doing a government loan. Is the IRS going to find out about it? And now they're in trouble. I just want to open up that the answer is no. The IRS lets you do some of that stuff, right? But it will catch you if you don't track it the right way.
Right. And the IRS lets you do it. And also in the position that you occupy, you don't disclose that information. I mean, that's not your role. That's not your interest. It's not your responsibility. And so that's never going to happen. I understand the concern and trepidation. You know, I had it recently where someone said, well, I'll give them my P&Ls, but I'm not giving them my tax returns. And I said, is everything on the books? They said, yeah. I said, so what the hell's the difference? Like, why you worry about it? Well, you know, they have the capability. They said, it's all there anyways. And yeah. And if you can't, if you want to sell this business and everything, your books and records are clean, you're going to have to provide that information. And mm-hmm. So I understand the concern. To me, if I'm sitting on the seller side, I'm more concerned to make sure I'm doing right by my business and not treating it like a personal ATM machine, although I understand that theory. But they have to understand when it comes to selling the business, if they want to add those items back in, they have to be able to prove them. And part of it is, you know, from a buyer's perspective, you ask, okay, well, can you prove them? How are you going to prove them? And are you willing to prove them? Because not, you have to have all those three pieces in place.
Bingo. Boy, thank you for saying that. And for our listeners out there, if you are an aspiring business buyer, most of the businesses that I've run into that have these, I call them verbal ad backs, or the broker listing summary will disclose, oh yeah, there were these one-time expenses and such. I want to get them right away because the bank is going to want them right away. And a lot of the challenge today, Richard, and you would agree, many of these businesses are listed on the market talking about these seller ad backs, but they don't have the proof. It's crazy, right?
Well, it is crazy in a lot of levels because you have ad backs that are put into place by brokers or sellers on their own selling a business where they can't necessarily prove them. A lot of them are arbitrary numbers. And you see this very often, what I tell buyer clients is any number that's too round with all zeros, like, is usually a BS number, right? Mm-hmm. If it's $27,242.63, chances are that's a lot more accurate than $28,000. And they put in the ad backs, and they make I understand the ad backs are fine. Like, there's never a problem, right? If you're doing an adjustment, and I've had businesses where I have no ad backs. I've had other ones where there's a laundry list, and we say where I've had either working with representing a buyer or seller, it, mm-hmm. either case is okay. It doesn't really matter, but they have to be legit. And I say legitimate from a couple of standpoints. One, you have to be able to prove them, meaning there's a paper trail. Because if there's no paper trail, forget about them. That's number one. Number two is they have to be legitimate ad backs that stand on their own. And you see that a lot in the examples you gave, such as, you know, one-time legal expenses, or I've seen it in cases where there's a one-time legal expense, but it's something that's going to carry over, and it may not be a one-time legal expense. Had it a couple of years ago where a client of mine made a huge company party of the year, spent 50 grand. Beautiful. Everybody was thrilled. I mean, it was supposed to be unbelievable. And they wanted to add that back. She said, well, we only did that once every 10 years, but you did it for the betterment of the business and for the employees, right? And at that point in time, you felt it was necessary, whether to thank the employees or to raise morale or whatever the case may be. It's not an ad back. And so you lose so much credibility with a buyer if you put in inaccurate ad backs. Not only are they inaccurate and you may not be able to prove them, but the buyer looks and say, well, if this is such a stretch and this is BS, like what about everything else?
Yeah. So
choose your ad backs intelligently, making sure that they are accurate, provable, and legitimate.
Yep. That's right. There we go, says Patrick. Thank you for, for that comment. There we go is right. I see Mike is here. Thank you, Mike. You made it. We appreciate your support. So another area before we get into some of the usual ad backs, the large ones, Richard, what about the everyday month to month business owner ad back, personal cell phone, auto expense, lunches? You know, they add that back as if it's cash flow for the buyer, but they're going to have the same expenses.
Bingo. That's the deciding factor. So if you need a cell phone to operate your business, it's not an ad back. If you use if you never leave the office and you don't need your vehicle for the business, well, then it's an ad back.
Yeah.
No question. But if you're going to see customers and you're taking them to lunch and entertainment is part of it.
Yeah.
Right. And the next buyer is going to incur it. It's not an ad back. And you know where you see that a lot related to vehicles, where they had the full depreciation for a while, 100% depreciation. If you bought assets over a certain amount of money, and I think a Range Rover over $240,000 qualified.
Uh-huh.
We said buyers buying Range Rover and depreciating the whole thing. And the guy never left his office. So that's not an ad back. It's the most obvious way to think about this is if the buyer is not going to need this in their business in order to run their business status quo the way you ran it, if they're not going to need it, then it is an ad back. But if they're going to need their cell phone, if they're going to need their car to visit people, if they're going to have customer, promotional items or entertainment, or they're going to go the other side is, for example, they write up a lot of travel where they go to, if it could be a convention, right?
That's right.
And so they take their spouse and they go to the convention and they spend 12 grand and it's an exotic location and all is wonderful. And they want to add it back. No, well, you can add back your spouse, but you can't add back yours.
Exactly.
Because you were going to go there anyways.
Yeah.
And even if you say, no, I had no intention of going. We never go to trade shows. Well, you know what? If I'm sitting there as a buyer, I'm saying, I'm calling bullshit. Because that may not make sense, right? I mean, it's a trade show related to the industry. If you're in the construction business and you go to a knitting convention, that's entirely different than going to a concrete convention. And so, you don't want to lose credibility with the buyer. And that's why sellers and buyers have to go through this diligently.
Diligently. So I'd like to start at the top of the list of some ad backs. And number one, obviously, is the current owner's salary. And what I'd like our listeners who are potential business buyers out there to understand, the owner's salary today, and in some cases, these are baby boomers that have lifted their salary up over the years because they deserve to. They're 10, 15, 20 years into the business, and they could be pulling a 200 grand salary. And yes, I do see that with business owners. So now we have a millennial business buyer. Is the millennial business buyer that's transitioning in going to need to pull a $200,000 salary? Probably not. Maybe he only needs 100 grand. So what does that do? It puts $100,000 of that current founding owner's salary back into the cash flow, which in some cases can make the deal happen, right? Because yes. Now we're improving the bottom line for the buyer's loan project.
Well, yes. So it's exactly correct. But there's two parts of it. One is for the purposes of the loan, it demonstrates more cash flow that's able to service the debt. So yeah. In that case, yes, because the seller is taking out 200. I, as a buyer, only need 100. So I have use of an extra $100,000 to service the debt. Mm-hmm. What buyers need to be very cautious about, however, right, is how does that play into the valuation? Because yeah. You don't have that soft, because all of the owner benefits, all of the owner salary and compensation goes to the add back.
Yeah.
100%, because it's an owner operator. So you're slicing and dicing a little bit, but certainly for the presentation purposes and presentation negotiation and approval process, mm-hmm. if a buyer can take out less, then by all means, you want to put that to the top of the list, because that's an extra $100,000 to service debt. That'll service like $750,000 or something. Like it's a big
right.
number.
Now let's flip it. Sometimes I have buyers come to me and they tell me that they don't need that much salary, but the underwriter is going to look at your household expenses. They try to say, no, I only need a $40,000 salary, when they're leaving corporate America earning perhaps $85,000 a year. The underwriter is going to scratch their head, and I see it all the time. They're like, you're used to living on that kind of a salary. What makes me think you're going to live on a $40,000 salary? Because the buyer is trying to punch it through where there's enough cash flow to support the loan project payment. Or this listing broker is trying to say, just reduce your salary so it cash flows. No, 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 no. Does that make sense, Richard?
Well, there's a reason why they're underwriters, is because they're smart. And there's a reason why they're underwriters and not loan sharks, right? They're underwriters because they're going to go through this and say, that's just not realistic, mm-hmm. versus, you go to a loan shark and they don't really care. They're just going to give you the money. Just make sure you pay it back. But they're not going to buy that. Like it's no different than mortgage fraud. It's not going to work. I mean, these are not idiots. These underwriters are bright people. And the first step, and I mean, my guess is in most cases, you would catch it before it even gets to an underwriter. So you're not fooling anyone. I mean, everybody's going to know that. So you present documents that are legitimate. It's a credibility issue at every stage. And that's another step, where you're going to submit something on a loan application. Mm-hmm. Make it accurate. I mean, legitimate and accurate.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing up the fact that your front end consultant, your front end lender, the experience that they have in these transactions matters most. Because if you're dealing with, a very young SBA lender that doesn't know how to look at the global picture, the household expenses, what are we earning now? They're just going to slap that deal into underwriting, and you're going to waste a lot of time and money. And that's why there is a rap out there that SBA takes forever. Well, a lot of reason why it takes forever is because the wrong deals are being punched through into the underwriter's queue, slowing up the system. So that's why Headbands and Handkerchiefs is here today, Richard, to improve that process. Am I right?
you're absolutely right. That the education is such an important piece of the equation.
Yeah.
And to your point related to having someone vet this before the underwriter gets it, a consultant or what have you, it's, similar to, the requirement that there's got to be some relative business experience in the business that you're acquiring. Yeah. And a good consultant is not fudging the details. It's not BS. It's not nonsense, but they're able to dig really deep into what you've done in your career and see, is there, can we connect the dots between what you've done in the past and what this business needs as the criteria for its manager. If you just take this, your application, you've fired into an SBA lender, and you haven't been thoughtful about your resume and bio and relative experience, you just get rejected. It's like, you want to have experts to the extent that you can afford them, right? Mm-hmm. At every step of the process. I mean, that's that with expert advice, because if you're going, unless you've done this a bunch of times before, you're just going to be much better off having the right team around you to get you to the finish line. It's just pretty simple.
The qualified are the ones who have walked through the fire, and not just once, several times, because every deal brings a different scenario. I would like to toss in quick for our loyal listeners here. We will get to some questions at the bottom of the hour. We see them coming in, and our producer Sia is behind the scenes. Does she have a bell to ring for us? Is she awake back there? I don't know. Maybe she's got something back there for us. Hey!
She's awake.
There she is. She's awake. That's our producer, Sia, behind the scenes. So, Patrick, I see your questions. We'll get to them here at the bottom of the hour. Now, let's talk about one-time expenses. And I'll give maybe one or two examples real quick, and then maybe you can share one or two examples, Richard. I think back to a couple of deals. Maybe it's a business that has to take care of any of the leasehold improvements, and they're responsible for the central air conditioning in their unit of where their business operates. That's a huge expense. Yep. Good Lord, my own personal home, 2 years ago, we had to replace our central air, and that was a big chunk of money. I think we had to drop at that time like $5,800 for central air conditioning. Think about a big company, a big business. Well, that's a one-time expense because we don't expect the new owner having to pay that. And that expense for that massive central air system, that was like an $80,000 one-time expense in 1 year. Yes. Get us the proof. Show us the receipt. You paid it out of the business account. Get a paid invoice. I'll show it to my underwriter. We'll add that $80,000 back to cash flow. That's a one-time expense, right?
Absolutely.
So what do you have for maybe an example of a one-time expense?
I actually prepared, so I'm going to put on my glasses.
Let's go. Bring them on.
So the big one is depreciation, because sellers, brokers, they add back, you, and correctly so, you add back depreciation to come up with your seller's discretionary earnings, owner benefits, whatever you want to call them. And that's a correct add back, non-cash expense. It's correct. But the incidence of them doing an offset for future capital expenditures is probably 1 out of 100. You can add back the depreciation, but those assets have to be replaced. Now, if they have to be replaced in the course of the next 3 to 5 years, you need to reduce the depreciation number by a number that my mother would say, putting money away for a rainy day. Meaning, if you want to take if there's a depreciation expense of, let's call it $300,000, but you know over the course of the next 5 years that you're going to have to buy equipment worth $200,000, you've got to reduce that amount by $40,000 for each one of the 5 years of financials. So depreciation is not just boom, like this vomited out add back. There's an offset to that, right? And people need to pay attention to it because it's very rarely done. And that, and so you need to dig into the useful life of the equipment and similarly what you're going to have to expend in reasonably over in the course of the next, you know, 1, 3, 5 years. You also see it, you touched upon earlier, automobiles and phones. There's two other ones which are really important, which is if there's manager in place or family members in place that are going to be left, or any employees that are going to leave that have to be replaced that you know about, and making sure that they're a salary is commensurate with what you're going to have to pay a new hire.
Yeah.
And you see that more. I remember there was a restaurant many years ago selling and asking the guy, this was a story told to me by a broker, and it was so spot on. He was asking about certain people. The buyer was asking about certain people who were working there and said, that nice lady over there who's at the hostess stand, how much she get paid? Get paid. It's my wife. I don't pay her. It's my wife. And then what about the other guy there? Well, that's my son. He lives in my house. I don't pay him. Well, those people are going to have to be replaced. So thinking about replacement income. And the other one is related to real estate, where whether there is or not real estate involved in the transaction, if you're not acquiring the real estate, but you're going to remain in the real estate, you have to make sure that what the business is currently paying the owner for that property as a lease on an ongoing basis is market rate, because there may be an adjustment. And oftentimes it's the inverse. The business is overpaying because the seller owns the property and wants to reduce their, wants to add more equity into their property. So they overpay rent. So that's an adjustment the other way. But those are the three big ones that I see.
Yeah. And I'd like to add to those three big ones that you just talked about, the family, the spouse, the folks that supposedly are working and now we got to replace them, or in some cases the owner is paying them and they're not even at the business. They don't work.
Correct.
We can add back on the lender side W-2s of family members where the owner deducted an expense even though they don't work there, just to reduce his tax liability. I want to see those W-2s for the last couple of years, and then I will add that salary back. But we have to prove too that they really aren't working at the business.
Correct.
And I love how you mentioned rent. I had one instance a couple of years ago. Rent expense seemed really reasonable. And the founder in the building that he was renting from, it was a gymnastics center. The rent was really low because the lease was signed like 15 years ago, where rents right. were much less.
Right.
And I always recommend to my buyers, get talking to that landlord immediately, because if anything major is going to change with that rent expense, or this happens a lot, they want to sell the building because the SBA wants to make sure you, the new owner, are going to have a lease that can be renewed matching the 10-year term of the SBA loan.
Right.
Okay.
And the landlord, the lease assignment has to be done very early, because oftentimes, yes. it's on different terms, as you said. They may raise the rent. They may not want to rent it. For whatever reason, you got to address that earlier.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Amen to that. Because I had that gymnastics center. They wanted to double the rent for our buyer, which threw the deal out the window. But there was some hard negotiating being done, and we finally got the seller to realize, you can't just double the rent and then sell your business, So finally he lowered the rent. We worked it out. But if we're not having those conversations early on about expenses and add backs and looking at it and getting the proof early on, people, early on.
Yeah. And one of the things, that just for some insight to buyers when they're looking at leases, there's always an assignment clause, a transfer clause, what have you. And sometimes they get a little complicated. The landlord may require the seller to stay on the lease as a guarantor for a while. If your financials aren't robust, those things happen. But the language that you want to look for in the assignment clause, and that's across North America, is that even though they say that very often that the lease assignment is subject to the sole discretion of the landlord, the language you want to look for is that the assignment will, in quotes, will not be unreasonably withheld. Yeah. As long as you have that language in there, then the landlord can't just be an ass and say, I'm not assigning the lease. They can get themselves actually into a legal jackpot if mm-hmm. they're not cooperative. Now, if they have good reason that they... the buyer's financials don't pass, or they're selling the business or whatever. Well, those are legitimate reasons. But other than that, they can't just say, I'm not as, they can't just throw a speed bump up in the deal and say, I'm not assigning it just because I don't want to. So you right. look for that language.
Yes, indeed. Look for that language. So if there's one message I want our listeners to take away, and maybe you'll have a thought on this too, Richard, based on today's episode, seller discretionary addbacks. My message to any aspiring buyers out there, you can't trust what is in the broker listing summary as true and accurate to what the bank will approve as cash flow to support your loan project. So what do we do when you work with me? We're going to jump on it out of the gates. I'm not saying it's all wrong in the listing summary. I'm just saying let's verify and get the facts. That's the takeaway I want. And we're going to walk through those add backs together to make sure, does it make sense and do we have the proof before I shop your loan file to get the best loan project out there. That would be my takeaway to share with everyone that's listening. What are your thoughts, Richard? What would be your one?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a nugget, but it's going to dovetail upon what you're saying, which is understanding that there's a difference between add backs that a lender is going to allow and add backs that are legitimate to be calculated as far as your valuation is concerned. Mm-hmm. And so when you're looking at the valuation and you get the list of add backs, you want to go through that, of course, diligently, making sure that everything is provable, and understand while you're going to use that final number, that adjusted number, as your valuation between you and the sellers, what you come up with, not all those add backs are going to be acceptable to a lender. There could be, you know, they're not necessarily always aligned. And so when it comes to add backs, of course, you want to make sure that they're provable. Mm-hmm. I mean, the obvious one is you can't add back what you didn't expense, but understanding that add backs have to be, are ones that are going to be not in the normal course of the business for a new buyer.
Yeah. Yep. Right on. Thank you for adding that. So let's just take a break here to talk about our sponsors, and then we'll open up the Q&A, because I do know there's a LinkedIn glitch. If you're a mobile user, we don't see your questions. Our producer has given us a private message here in the chat. But let's talk about our sponsors real quick. Let's bring up our first and foremost sponsor, Brilliant Beam Media. Let's bring up their code here. Brilliant Beam Media, they take care of all of your digital marketing needs. And that is who we partner with, Headbands and Handkerchiefs, here today's show, to make sure the gremlins don't steal our show. I tried to do this on my own, ladies and gentlemen, running a live stream. It just doesn't work. You need Sia and her team from Brilliant Beam Media to support you. So reach out to them. QR code is on the screen. If you're thinking of doing a live, her team will get you going. All right. Number two sponsor. I love it. That's Sia. Number two sponsor, Hounds of Business Community. Bring that up there. There he is. The leader of the Hounds of Business. Copy that QR code, ladies and gentlemen. And if you want to join a group that supports small businesses up and down and all around worldwide, we support one another. Mike offers incredible training to help you lift your business up to greater social media presence. And just the group in general, we're all about lifting one another and supporting one another to make sure that the solutions we all provide to our clients are being known. Because you don't know unless you ask. So instead of asking, we're going to just tell you in the Hounds Business of Community of what we've got available to you for solutions. And then my third sponsor that Richard and I have for Headbands and Handkerchiefs is Walking Tall. And this is an organization that supports mental health awareness. Please take a picture with your phone. It's in your hand on your desk. I know you're looking at it right now. Scan that QR code and follow the Walking Tall movement. This is a group of two guys and a doctor who support mental health awareness. They are victims of massive shootings, and we are all pulling together because we need each other, human to human, to support. And furthermore, mental health awareness has to be on the forefront. No more pretending. No more pretending online. Let's just be who we are and support one another. And thank you to our sponsors. So let's move to the questions. Let's pull them up here. And let me see what maybe Sia can pull one up here on.
Here's one that was David Munoz asked something about inventory, which is a great question.
Okay.
So David asked, I was told inventory is included in the sales price. Why is it if the profitability of the business has already calculated the cost of buying that inventory, they don't get their inventory for free? That's true and correct. But here's the thing to consider. A business, and especially at the smaller end, actually it applies larger as well, but certainly at the smaller end, is a business is sold to a buyer on the assumption that, assuming everything being status quo, they're going to have an optimal level of inventory to operate the business. There are some cases in retail stores where there's a value put on the business and the inventory is valued separately, typically at the day of closing, and that's added to the equation. Irrespective of that, even in those cases, when you take the multiple, which is always lower, plus the inventory, it still has to fit into a parameter of a return on investment. And so when you do, while it seems to be a disconnect, David, that you take a business, you value it based on the cash flow or the, you know, the seller's discretionary earnings, you multiply that, wouldn't you add the inventory? No, because you need that inventory to generate that level of income upon which you're valuing the business. So there are exceptions to the rule, mostly in retail, but by and large, businesses are sold including an optimal level of inventory so that when the buyer takes over the next day, they can operate the business status quo, and the valuation at a multiple takes that into consideration. And David, if there's anything, we want to get to some other questions that are unclear, you have my contact number or contact information that comes up across the screen. Feel free to get in touch with me directly, and I'm happy to jump onto a call and provide some more color on that.
Oh, that's awesome, Richard. And maybe Sia can throw up, before we move to the next question, your top 10 things that sellers don't tell you, the QR code. And whoever's listening, if you want some additional information, here's 10 things that sellers won't tell you. You want to touch on that, Richard?
Sure. It's a great report combined after 34 years in this business of things that are commonplace that sellers won't disclose. And if you go to... you could either do it through the QR code or go to richardparker.com, subscribe to the report. And there's, I think there's 13 or 14 subsequent emails, which are great tips about the entire process of buying a business. So if you're, even considering buying a business, it's despite the fact that I wrote it myself, it really is good information.
I love it. Well, that was a great question. So, and David, thank you for putting that up. That inventory, that's a very common question, and Richard did a great job of explaining it. What else do we have here for questions? Let's see. Oh, here's Patrick talked about, here we go. Do you folks keep a list of businesses you represent for sale? So I don't list businesses personally for sale. What I do is help individuals that want to purchase, finance, and establish money-making business, get prepared, pre-qualified, fully vetted by the SBA, then we search for the business. That is the proper way to start your business buying venture, is to see what you, the individual, have a desire for, and most importantly, what do you qualify for? Because businesses range from $150,000 up to 5-10 million. And if it was up to the business brokers, they would sell you the most expensive businesses that they can, because that's where they make an income. So we need to discuss what that is and work together to figure out, where do we go shop then to find that eligible business for sale? Richard, do you list any businesses?
I list a very limited amount. I take on a few engagements during the course of the year. It is very highly selective. The majority of my time is spent educating business buyers. You know, our program, How to Buy a Good Business, a great price, sold about a little over 100,000 copies of those. And most of my days, just because I've been blessed to have a really wonderful career, enjoyment-wise and financially. So I spend my day on the phone answering buyer questions and emails. I mean, I never charge anybody. And so that's really what my day consists of. I don't represent, I represent very few businesses, and typically in the market of, you know, probably, you know, my sweet spot is about $2.5 to $7.5 million of EBITDA. And I just handle a few during the course of the year. By the way, Sandy asked a question about the, and you and I may have this, different answers on this. Do you need to have, a great credit score? So why don't you answer it from a lender's perspective, and I'll answer it from a deal perspective.
Yes. So yes, you do need to have a good credit score. And just like a first-time home buyer, first-time business owners, first-time business buyers, you do need to have a good credit score. Now, banks have thresholds. Some banks have thresholds where you got to be at a certain number. Others will mitigate it. So there are banks that recognize bad things can happen to good people. Therefore, if there is a bankruptcy, a personal bankruptcy that maybe happened 3-4 years ago, there are some banks that will consider taking you on with a letter of explanation that's presented to the underwriter. And that's my job to coach you on that. But if you're coming to the table with a credit score that's suffering because you're taxing your personal credit cards out to the point where they're at the limit. You've got some late pays happening the last 12 months, 24 months. Nobody's going to want to finance a house for you, much less a business. So yes, you do need a good credit score. Are there things that can happen bad to good people? Of course, but it's got to match up to the story. And I help coach individuals on that. What would you say to that, Richard?
So on my answer to that is, as first of all, I agree 100% with Deb said, except for one part of the equation, which is if you're going to look for significant leverage through a type of loan like an SBA loan, you've got to have a credit score that's going to meet their criteria of that. There's no escaping that. In those situations where there is you don't have the credit score to go through that type of financing, well, you have to look at alternatives. And in those cases, what you need to do is, you know, seller financing is going to be the road to go down, because that, while they will check your credit score, you're going to be able to establish a relationship with that seller, hopefully build trust with one another, trust and credibility. And obviously you want to disclose that, but if you can't use SBA type financing for mm-hmm. your deal, your only option is either pay cash, which again, I'd tell everyone don't pay cash for business, even if you had it, but your only option is going to be seller financing. And in that case, your credit score is not important. It's mm-hmm. it. When I say not important, they will look at it. But what's more important is they want to make sure that you have the skill to operate that business successfully mm-hmm. for them to consider financing you. So it really depends what road you're going to go down. And clearly with SBA, I mean, you got to have the right thing to the point if you're going to buy a house or a car or whatever, you have to be at a certain level. But you do have some options if your credit score isn't optimal. That, without question, that should not prevent you from going through the process.
And I would like to add to that, Richard, if you do go 100% seller financing, please engage Richard, somebody that's going to protect you, the business buyer, because when you don't have a bank, an SBA lender or a consultant like me on your side doing the due diligence as deep and heavy as banks do, going 100% seller financing on your own is a nightmare. You need
going to happen. I mean, the concept, you have to put a down payment down on a business. I wish I could tell people that you could buy a business for zero money down and get 100% financing. Yeah, you can get a shit business, pardon my French, because no one's going to give a complete stranger, well, that'll be a whole other subject, but no one's going to sell a good business to a complete stranger and give them 100% financing. So if your credit is down and you're going down the road, I wish I could tell people how to get businesses for 100% financing that are good businesses. Because if that were the case, I wouldn't have sold 100,000 copies of my course. I would have sold 100 million, but it's a lie. And so it's a terrible lie. And so if you don't have good credit, but you're going to go down the road to seller financing, you're going to need to have a down payment on the business. Right. That ranges dramatically, but getting a business for 100% seller financing is one out of a 10,000 cases if you're lucky. So there is a component. Usually it's anywhere 30, 50, sometimes 70. I've done them at 70 and 80%, but zero down, it just doesn't exist.
Right on. I have another question here. Oh, here we go. How do you calculate market rates for those employees? Would you like to answer that one, Richard?
Yeah, there's a lot of it is geographical, but some of the websites like Indeed and other personnel websites could really give you some good parameters and relate it to geography. And sometimes you need to just, you may need to engage on a temporary basis, a recruiter, not to find someone, but to give you some consultation related to the parameters of the job. But it's very available information, especially if it's more standard type position. It becomes a little trickier the higher that you go up the employee scale when you get into more management level or specialized trades. But the information is available. Indeed is a terrific marketplace to search for it.
That's great. And Patrick had another question about how do you walk through those expenses, the add backs we were talking about earlier, in a clear, transparent way. Number one, right away out of the gates. But I'm going to put in a big but here. No broker and no seller is going to release any information until they know you've got proof of funds or a fully vetted SBA pre-qualification letter as a business buyer. They don't want to release anything until they know you qualify. So that's my job, to present you like a diamond in the rough, because these brokers get hundreds of business buying calls per day and emails. The shinier I make you look as a business buyer, that you're fully vetted and you're qualified, you're going to speed pass to the front of the line, and that broker is going to want to talk to you, and then they will share information. If they don't, Patrick, if they don't, and any other business buyers out there listening, if they don't want to share information with you and you've got proof of funds that you are a legitimate, eligible, qualified buyer, they don't want to share you with us those expenses, we're out of here. We're moving on to the next business. And take it from me, over 100 transactions. When I was younger, I was a sucker for business brokers that would promise me that the stuff was coming. And I believe what happened, the sellers were promising the brokers that the stuff was coming. It doesn't come. It does not show up. So if you can't come up with it right away and I have an eligible buyer, we're moving on.
Yep. And I have a question. It's a great point. And I have a question here. I see I'm reading, a question from Nate Duncan that someone actually looks like they answered it, but I want to make sure I got this straight. Will there be a replay available? Well, Deb could touch on that after. And then there was a question here, do ad backs need to be part of the LOI, or do we need to address it prior to the submission of an LOI? So the answer is what Nate said, but it's also both. One is you don't want to submit an LOI until you look at those ad backs and could at least vet them at a high level, because what's the use of putting together a valuation or an offer on a price of a business if it's going to change dramatically? So the quality of the information that you receive from the seller will dictate whether or not it's going to have to be massaged further. But the only time that I would consider, or one of the only times that I would consider putting to an LOI when I haven't seen all the ad backs yet, if this was a business that I recognize is going to move quickly, and good businesses sell fast, but if I believe it's going to move quickly, I will put in an LOI for full price and terms.
Yeah.
Just to lock up the business. And then you go back and you look at the numbers. You're not going to be misleading, but you want to let the sellers know that, you know, it's subject, of course, to due diligence and the verification. But in an ideal world, and notwithstanding that type of example, you want to get as much information as you can related to the ad backs and the adjustments and the financials that you can, so that you're able to compile a valuation that is going to be pretty accurate, assuming nothing changes.
Mm. And that is why you are Richard Parker at richardparker.com.
What a segue. Look at you. Okay, look at you. Okay, very good. Good
stuff, man. That's very a clip right there in the making.
Very good.
What do we got here? Nate Duncan.
Yes, go ahead.
What does he have here? Will there be a replay available? Yes. LinkedIn will live stream replay our live streams on our profiles. You'll always find them. I also have a YouTube channel. Richard, do you have your YouTube channel yet? Are you working on that?
It's at Great. Richard Parker Diomo.
Okay. Fantastic. And we are branching out in 2024. We're live streaming on all channels. We're going big or we're going home, Richard.
We're going big or going home. And just to let anybody, you reach me on richardparker.com, but Diomo is my original company. It's Diomo. It's the abbreviation for doing it on my own. And that's the company I've had around for 34 years. So, but the social media is all at Richard Parker Diomo.
Doing it on my own. I love that.
Thank you.
I love that.
Even when I've sold some of the business, I wouldn't sell the name.
There we go. Let's remember aspiring entrepreneurs out there that want to buy a business. Let's change the narrative norm. Let's not start the journey blindfolded, just looking for a business and talking to business brokers. Start with business buying experts that understand how do you qualify to buy a first-time business, or in many cases, second and third businesses, because I have buyers that own multiple businesses, and that's a deck of cards that needs to be shuffled and figured out as well, right? So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I see a question here from Patrick Allen, which says, what business segments are you seeing exiting now? I don't know if you meant exiting now or exciting now. There's, you know, what businesses are bought and sold all the time, regardless of the economy, regardless of interest rates, recession-proof, non-recession-proof. The market is very fluid. It has its ups and downs, of course, if there's a real catastrophic impact one way or the other. But what I'm seeing a very, very popular right now. And what I mean by very, very popular is there's multiples are getting a little outrageous is in a lot of the home service businesses, plumbing, heating, electrical, pest control, landscaping, ones with a high level of recurring revenue. There's a lot of roll-ups going on within the private equity world. And those roll-ups typically acquire a large platform business, then buy a bunch of small ones. And because they're the level that they must be at is less important when they're tucking in the additional businesses. But home services are really popular right now, which when, again, to qualify, when I say popular, that's when a whole lot of people are very attracted to that a particular sector and the multiples start to go on fire. It usually does not end well, just to let you know.
Yep. Right on. Well, Richard, we managed to make it to the 45-minute mark.
Yes.
We promised ourselves to make this impactful in 30 to 45 minutes max because time is short for everybody. We want to thank all of you for joining us, our sponsors. We will be back again next week, Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern. Next week's topic is business brokers, friend or foe.
Yes. And then we also have a special note for thank you for Devin Craig, Ankit Singh, George Bennett, Zahid Kamran, and Sandy Chauncey. Thank you very much, guys, for attending.
Yes. And the Hounds of Business community and anyone else out there supporting us, we thank you. Until next time, I believe there's a big holiday. If you celebrate Christmas, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, whatever it is that you celebrate, this is the season. We call it separation season, but let's get ready for 2024, and we will see you next week, Thursday.
Bye, Deb.
Bye, Thanks, Richard. Guys.